This is KDNK, Carbondale Community Access Radio, Glenwood Springs, Carbondale, the Roaring Fork Valley, and beyond. Broadcasting at 88.1 FM and via translators. K202AB at 88.3 in Glenwood Springs, K202AT at 88.3 in Aspen, K203EG at 88.5 in Basalt, K203EH at 88.5 in Redstone, K228AG at 93.5 in Leadville, K234BJ at 94.7 in Old Snowmass, K235AP at 94.9 in Thomasville, and K260BZ at 99.9 in Snowmass Village.
Someday about 25 years from now, when we've all grown old from a wondering how, we'll all sit down at the city dump and talk about the good old days. Oh, you'll pass a joint and I'll pass a wine, and anything good from a down the line. A lot of good things went down one time back in the good old days. Yeah, the good old days are past and gone. Done, gone, gone. That's my life when I sing this song about back in the good old days. Sometimes we get to thinking that we're almost done and there ain't nothing left that we can figure out. And I guess it must have seemed a lot more like that back in the good old days. But when you gotta go, you gotta go. There's always somebody, don't you know? I hang around saying, well, I told.
Will we have enough food to feed our growing world population in the coming decades and avoid sharply escalating food prices? Society's most basic challenge is arguably to produce and distribute enough food for its citizens. In 2023, 733 million people faced hunger and 2.3 billion were moderately or severely food insecure. Feeding a growing world population is becoming more difficult in the face of climate change, pest resistance to traditional treatments, and misguided government policies that limit how much food ends up on our plates. Policies to support biofuels, organic agriculture, local foods, and small farms, and to oppose genetically modified foods all reduce food production on existing land. This leads to higher food prices, increased carbon emissions, and less natural habitat as croplands expand. Richard Sexton, who has spent his life in agriculture from growing up and working on his family's dairy and crop farm in central Minnesota to his career as a professor in the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics at UC Davis, paints a stark picture of the problems we must overcome to solve the world's food supply problem in his new book, Food Fight: Misguided Policies, Supply Changes, and the Impending Struggle to Feed a Hungry World. And we're joined with Richard Sexton by phone right here in the KDNK studio. Hi, Richard. Are you with us?
I am with you, and thank you for having me.
Yes, thanks for taking the time to join KDNK Community Radio today. How's everything going in your world?
Well, everything's going good. I'm actually in Denver right now at the professional meeting of the Agricultural and Applied Economics Association, and so it was a nice opportunity to slip away from the crowd and talk to you.
Oh, good. So I was just introducing you and your new book, Food Fight. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, it's really the compilation of the career in agriculture that I've had and work that I've done and work that colleagues have done. And, you know, I started piecing the putting the pieces of the puzzle together and recognize that, we were facing some challenges moving forward in this century, and we seem to be, for the most part, blithely ignorant of them. And so the book describes the growth in food demand that is certain to come in this century due to a big combination of things. Population continues to grow, albeit at a slower rate. Incomes will grow, and as incomes grow, particularly in the poorer parts of the world, people will consume more food. And then very, very importantly, and sometimes missed in these projections, is that the composition of what they consume will also change as incomes rise, with less reliance on traditional staples and more reliance on the diversified diets, which is good for their health. But it's well understood that animal products, dairy and meats, convert agricultural inputs into food outputs for humans less efficiently than if we just produce the food for humans, so that as we eat more of those foods moving forward, it will require more land and agriculture, more food production. So demand's growing, and we face the challenges that you mentioned in your introduction to expanding supply. There's great evidence that agricultural productivity growth, which has saved us in the past, has slowed relatively dramatically in recent decades. And then we face these unique challenges that will be posed by climate change and other factors that we really haven't faced in prior centuries. And then the kicker, what the book is really focused upon, is that we as a global society, as governments, countries, should be paying more attention to this, but yet instead we're doing things that we can certainly talk about as you wish, that are guaranteed to cause us to produce less food, not more. And so it's those harmful or misguided policies, as the book's subtitle says, that we really need to think about moving forward.
And, tell us about some of those policies.
Yeah, well, a couple of the big things are, we're very consciously taking land out of production. The U.S. operates a conservation reserve program that's taken out about 7% of our agricultural acres based on estimates. Over in Europe, they're intending to take 10% out by 2030, and they're doing it, again, in the name of an environment and conservation. But what that misses is that if we take it out here in the U.S. or we take it out in Europe, these are places where agriculture is very productive. More land is going to go into production in other parts of the world where probably it will be less productive. And if you want to do bad things for the environment, about the worst thing you can do is what they call extensification of the land base in agriculture, which is putting more land, converting virgin lands, forested lands, into agriculture. That's terrible for greenhouse gas emissions. It's terrible for biodiversity, habitat, and that type of thing. But that's inevitably what's going to happen. And so just taking land out consciously by policy is a big deal. And then as a public policy in many parts of the world, U.S., Europe, Japan, elsewhere, we're focusing on ways of producing food that are inefficient. Now, a number of your viewers might prefer to eat organic foods, but what we have to confront is that if you convert an acre or a hectare of conventional land into organic, you're going to get 30 to 45% less production than if it were kept in the conventional variant. So every time we convert lands from conventional to organic, more lands have to come into agricultural production to offset that. And just as one example, the Europeans have as their goal to have 25% of their land base inorganic by 2030. So that's just one very prominent example of government supporting expansion of organic agriculture, even though it is very detrimental to yield and then causes more land to be brought into production elsewhere in the world to make up for the lost production that we inevitably have when we convert conventional lands to organic lands.
Interesting. And I want to go back to converting virgin forest, as you said, into cropland to feed more. Well, let's go into corn and soybeans. Is that happening? I think of like a country like Brazil converting rainforest into growing more soybeans, and perhaps that's to feed animals, right?
Well, to feed animals or to produce biofuels. And you're absolutely right that that is happening in Brazil. I mean, the Amazon, the Brazilian rainforest, is the largest rainforest in the world, and it's being deforested at an alarming rate. And what's really happened in Brazil, and again, people sometimes miss this, is that they say, no, they're not growing soybeans in the Amazon, which is largely true. They're growing soybeans in the areas where heretofore they had raised cattle, and the cattle have moved into the Amazon. So even though they're not growing the soybeans there, they're growing it is the expansion of soybean production that has led to the deforestation of the Amazon, and largely it's due to the biofuels policies of the U.S., my home state of California, Europe, other parts of the world, which have explicit mandates to expand the production of biofuels, so corn to produce corn ethanol and soybean oil to produce diesel fuel. And so that has caused a lot of deforestation, not only in Brazil, but I have a PhD dissertation student whose work is showing that it has caused deforestation in Indonesia and Malaysia to plant palm plantations that then produce palm oil, which is taking the place of the soybean oil that would otherwise be used for cooking, but now is being used to produce diesel fuel.
Interesting. Yeah, that seems like quite a catch where most people think that politicians are doing the right thing by promoting the use of biofuels, right?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. When we put those policies in place, the renewable fuel standard in the U.S. was put into place around 2005, and my home state has its own set of policies called the low-carbon fuel standard. And in California, about 60%, if you buy diesel fuel, about 60% of that is made from bioproducts. So and a lot of that is soybean oil. Some of it's other things like tallow and so forth. But we didn't understand that when we put those policies into place 20 or so years ago. But, you know, it's really pretty basic in the sense that if we take acres out of food production and convert them into fuel production, then more acres are going to come in around the world to replace that lost food production, because the prices are rising. The prices rose dramatically for corn and soybeans over this period, and that incentivized their planting in Brazil. That incentivized the planting of palm in Indonesia and Malaysia, other places like Argentina. And so, you know, it's this expansion of the land base that basically takes away all of, you know, on net, the positive environmental benefits from, yes, those things, those fuels, those biofuels burn cleaner. But when you consider the emissions that we're gaining, increasing by this land use version, the environmental benefit on net goes away, unfortunately.
And we're adding ethanol to gasoline here in the United States. I'm not sure if it varies from state to state. I believe it's like 10% here in Colorado. I'm not sure what that's like in California. And that's coming from corn, right?
Yeah, it's 10% basically everywhere in the country. And that's a product of the renewable fuel standard. And yes, that's substantially all coming from corn ethanol. And so the largest corn producer in the world, by a long shot, is the U.S. But in any given year, we take 30 to 35% of our corn crop and use it to produce ethanol. So that's, I mean, a dramatic change because, again, prior to the renewable fuel standard, very little ethanol was produced from corn. And so this was a demand created by policy. And again, perhaps with good intentions in the sense of saying that, yeah, ethanol burns cleaner than fossil-based fuels, but then there's these unfortunate side effects that relate to land use conversion. So yeah, just think of it being a third of the corn we produce goes to produce ethanol.
And I'm assuming that most of that corn is genetically modified here in the United States.
Almost all of it, yes. Almost all of that corn is genetically modified, yes.
And help me understand why you are opposed to bans on GMO technologies.
Well, there's not any scientific evidence that shows any harms to GMOs. So there was a concern that it would be unhealthy for people to eat genetically modified products. There's zero evidence that that's true, and there's been, you know, they've been around now for decades. And as a practical matter, all of us consume GMOs to some extent because most sugar is GMO. So if you consume sugar, you're most likely consuming GMOs. And corn oils, soybean oils, things like that, that's almost all GMOs. So we're all consuming GMOs, but in many parts of the world, much of Europe and many parts of Africa, because Africa trades extensively with Europe just based on the geography, and Europe doesn't want the GMOs, so Africa and many African countries have banned them. But many studies, many studies have shown that there's probably a yield benefit on the order of 20 to 25% from producing the GMO variants, so GM corn versus conventional corn. So we're giving up a big expansion of yield in the places where we are banning the GM technology. And there's no health harms associated with it at all. So anybody that tells you that they are, that's just simply not true.
You've said the only real issue with GMOs is through pollination that can impact traditional varieties.
Yes, that is a fact. That could, you know, and that's a big reason why Mexico, for example, has problems with GM corn, because Mexico has a lot of very traditional varieties that they want to preserve for cultural reasons, among other things. And so, yeah, that can happen most certainly with GMOs, but there's ways to deal with that, because you can have buffers and so forth to prevent that kind of cross pollination. So that's not a reason to ban them most certainly. And you know, and if there is a concern about contamination of traditional varieties, then you know it can be handled through buffers and means like that. So there's answers to that question.
Yeah, I'm interested in that, and what kind of solutions you think how we can deal with that with buffers.
Well, yeah, I mean the cross pollination is only going to happen over restricted geographic areas, and so you know if you could easily put in place laws that are saying, you know, if you're going to grow GM corn, you have to have a buffer where there's not the GM corn growing for, some distance. I don't know what that distance would be, but I think the science is clear on what that would be. And so maybe you would grow like an alternative crop as a buffer between, where you're growing the GM product and traditional varieties were being grown, or, you know, again, you could just preclude it from being grown in certain areas where there were, was a significant preponderance of traditional varieties. I mean, it's not an issue here in the U.S. because, essentially the entire industry for soybeans and corn is GM. But if it were a country that was trying to preserve, again, primarily for cultural reasons, these traditional varieties, there would be ways to get around the problem. The traditional varieties will yield much less than the GM varieties, but, you know, I'm not going to be the one to say, no, you can't have your traditional varieties of corn. Obviously you can, but you shouldn't, throw out the baby with the bathwater, but you should implement policies where, you know, you can have the higher yielding GM varieties growing and preserve your traditional varieties.
You grew up on a small dairy farm in central Minnesota, is my understanding. And tell us about that. And I'm curious on what we're talking about with GM crops and traditional crops, what you saw there in Minnesota.
Well, I mean, I'm old enough so that when I was growing up, that was before the GM crops were even an opportunity. But, yeah, we had the type of small dairy farm that that doesn't really exist anymore because it's been replaced by the mega dairies. But while I was growing up there, it was a great, introduction to agricultural production, because in addition to the milk that we were selling, we sold steers and heifers and cull cows for beef, and then we raised crops primarily to feed our cattle. But we raised hay, corn, oats. And as I say in the book, my sister and I even tried growing a couple little cash crops to earn spending money. I remember one year we were trying to grow cucumbers, and that didn't go good for us, but it was a great introduction to agriculture and also sort of the challenges to, to trying to make a living, eke out a living on a small farm. And I talk about that in the book a little bit.
Great. If you're just tuning in, we're joined with Richard Sexton, professor at University of California, Davis, and the author of a new book, Food Fight. And Richard, how is climate change impacting crop yields?
That's a big deal. And the climate has grown over the last few decades, but albeit at about a third of degree Fahrenheit per decade. So we've experienced climate change so far, but the belief, the climate change researchers, the models tell us that the rate of climate change will accelerate as we move through this century. And there have been literally hundreds of studies across a wide variety of crops in many, many different parts of the world. And they unanimously say climate change will reduce crop yields, perhaps significantly. And so what I do in the book, just to get a benchmark, is I look across all of these studies, and basically a benchmark is to say for every degree Celsius, not Fahrenheit, so Celsius means basically think 1 degree Celsius is roughly 2 degrees Fahrenheit, but for every 1 degree Celsius that the temperature rises, yields on average across crops and areas reduces 4.7%, and so our National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in this country says, without mitigation, they expect temperatures will rise from the current rate levels 2.8 degrees Celsius, or roughly 5 degrees Fahrenheit on average. And so if we take that 4.7 and multiply it by 2.8, we get something over 13% yield reductions just due to climate change. And so now, maybe people can do things to mitigate that effect, but they aren't going to be able to eliminate that. And so that's just a new challenge. I mean, we haven't faced that kind of a challenge in the 20th century, the 19th century, or any point in time where we were moving forward and feeding a growing population. So, we just layer the challenges of climate change on top of everything else, and it's concerning. It's concerning. And so, as a global population, we should be thinking about ways that we can expand food production, because climate change, if the research is right, and there's been hundreds of studies, if the research is right, climate change will have a significant effect on yield across a wide variety of crops in a wide variety of locations.
And of course, like we began the conversation, there is that catch with expanding agricultural lands that increases the harms of climate change. What are some of the most obvious ways that we can address this through agriculture?
Well, for me, the most obvious, a couple of obvious things we can do. I mean, first of all, we can put the emphasis on getting more off a given land base. That's what they call intensification. So if you can expand yields on a given land base, that's the best way to increase food production, because then you're not adding lands and deforesting, virgin lands to expand into ag. And then the second thing that we've got to do is we've got to increase the rate of productivity growth. That's what's languished. The people that work in that area say it's due in part to the fact that as a government, as a country, the U.S. has reduced its agricultural research expenditures. And then we're probably putting significant brakes on the private sector doing it because, of excessive regulation, bureaucracy, delays, and so forth. So if you're investing significant sums of money developing new and improved feeds, better pesticides, whatever it may be, if you're afraid that you're not going to be able to actually market, get get the product approved to be marketed, you're not going to spend the money. And so, you know, that's a significant concern. So, I mean, my two recipes really for getting, you know, getting more food as we move forward in this century is to, you know, in some sense, remove the shackles off of agriculture. I mean, both public and private investment in agricultural productivity needs to be expanded, and we need to emphasize getting more off a given land base so that we're doing less expansion of the land base, and that would be better for both food production and it would be better for the environment, right? So many of these things that we've done in the name of the environment are actually harmful on net once we incorporate the fact that we're causing the land base in agriculture to expand significantly, and it'll expand more as we move through this century because prices will rise as food becomes more scarce, and that will incentivize more land expansion, more planting, more environmental harm.
Why do you think that we're not more focused on preventing hunger and malnutrition?
Well, that's a great question because we haven't solved the problem. I mean, I was listening to a major talk here at this conference last night, and the speaker, who was the head of one of our major international research agencies, was describing statistics similar to what I have in the book about the number of people in the world that are hungry. It's about 730 million that face hunger and malnutrition. And then, as you said in your introduction, over 2 billion are food insecure. And those numbers really haven't gone down. They jumped up during COVID, and they haven't come back down post-COVID. So we can't claim that we've solved the food production problem. But, my feeling is that, we've come very, very focused on the environmental consequences of agricultural production. I mean, it is a significant source of climate emissions in its own right. So there's a lot of people saying, hey, we got to get agriculture to reduce its emissions. That's going to reduce production too. But the thing that we have to emphasize is that being efficient in our production, producing it on the most efficient lands, not taking lands out of production in the U.S. or Europe in the name of the environment, and avoiding the expansion of the land base, that's the way we're going to get more food and better environmental outcomes. And so, a part of the reason that I wrote the book is that, we've just become too focused on these other dimensions of food production and basically given short shrift to the idea that, yes, as we move forward in this century, we need to produce significantly more food to avoid increasing hunger and malnutrition and rising food prices.
And finally, we just have about a minute left or less, but let's talk a little bit about food waste and how we can reduce that.
Yeah, great point. Great question. And, the official statistics say we lose or waste across the entire supply chain maybe upwards of a third of food production. So that seems like low-hanging fruit as a way to actually produce more food because we don't have to actually produce more, we just have to waste less through the food chain. And I think there's some opportunities to do that. I think, and in fact, the U.S., Europe, World Bank, all of these major entities are saying, let's cut it in half. And that's a noble goal. I don't think we'll be able to achieve that for reasons that probably we don't have time to talk about in our remaining seconds here. I covered in detail in the book, but if we can reduce food waste and food loss, that's going to help. And if we keep that stuff out of the landfills, if it's in the landfills, it emits greenhouse gases. So that's a good thing to do, but I don't think we can cut it down by a half, which is what the goal is that our government, Europeans, others have set. So I think that's going to be a big challenge.
Richard Sexton, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with KD&K today. And how can listeners find out how to acquire your book?
Well, I think it's going to be available anywhere that you get books. So it's published by the University of California Press, so you can go there directly. But, you can go to Amazon Books, Target, any of the booksellers. It will be there. And so just search for Food Fight or my name, and you'll find it. And Yeah, I think it's a good read because it, you know, it backs up what it says with the relevant science, but it's not written in technical jargon and laden with a lot of that kind of stuff. And so it's meant to be a good read, but not somebody just blowing smoke because, yeah, it's all in the footnotes there. But, you know, it's backed up by what the science tells us.
Well, thanks again for taking the time, Richard, and have a good trip over there in Denver.
Great. I much appreciate you having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.